Okay, so today, Bezrat Hashem, we're going to be looking at Masechet Shvi'it. Shvi'it, of course, in Hebrew means the seventh, referring to the seventh year, which is also known as the Shnat Shemitah. If we have a farmer...
Did I take this Rashi to it?
No, it's from yesterday.
If we look at our farmer friend who 2 days ago was harvesting his products, his crops, and leaving various leftovers for the poor, and yesterday he finished harvesting his crops, and in the various years of the seven-year cycle, in the first 6 years he took his truma, his maaser rishon, gave the truma to the kohen, the maaser rishon to the levi, and depending which year it was, in the first and the second and the fourth and the fifth years, he also separated Maser Sheni, which he either took to Yerushalayim and ate it in Yerushalayim b'tahara, or perhaps he transferred the holiness to money, brought the money to Yerushalayim and went out to a nice restaurant, as we spoke about. That's what he did in the first year, in the second year, and also in the fourth year and the fifth year. In the third year and the sixth year, instead of Maser Sheni, he skipped his vacation in Yerushalayim, or he funded it privately, and instead he left the second tithe, not as Maaser Sheni, but as what's called Maaser Ani, and that also went to the poor people. Of course, after the sixth year comes the seventh. And the seventh year, the Torah sets up an entirely different concept, a concept which, among the laws we're, and I alluded to this, I think, both on Sunday and yesterday, of all the laws that we've sort of looked at in this little overview, this is the one where we come closest to actually observing it nowadays, even though we are far from the type of observance that the Torah actually envisioned. But it's the one that has the most practical ramifications, and for any of you who live in Israel, or who will have the opportunity to be here at any time during the upcoming Shemitah year, or even during the year afterwards. And as the laws of Shemitah, this is currently, we're in the month of Tammuz, near the end of the fifth year. The upcoming year beginning this Rosh Hashanah is the sixth year, and therefore a little over a year from now, Rosh Hashanah, Tav Shin Ayin Hey, right? I guess September or so, 2014, will be the beginning of the Shemitah year. The practical ramifications of that, for those who live here and perhaps have a garden in your backyard or in your front yard or something like that, the practical ramifications already begin less than a year from now. And certainly for any of us who consume fruits or vegetables immediately following Rosh Hashanah and continuing for almost 2 years, the practical ramifications, and bottles of wine even beyond that. Even now you may find bottles of wine from the last Shemitah year if you have a chance to look at it. So we're not dealing with halakha lema'aseh today. We're not going to be dealing with practical ramifications. I was asked yesterday if I could address that point, and unfortunately during the limited time I have, I don't really have the ability to, but I do have an article here that I wrote in the last Shemitah year. I did not look at it at all since then. Bezrat Hashem, I'll hopefully put out another edition, but in the meantime, this is a nice, I think it's nice. This is a, you'll have to tell me, but this is a summary of the practical applications of this. So there are copies here, and if you need more, Yosef, I gave the original to, so she can make more. But let's deal with it on the theoretical level. Let's start, as we did the other days, with the Psukim in the Torah, and then with some Mishnayot. If you can look, please, at the two biblical passages I gave you there on the sheet. Yeah, I have more over here.
Sorry, it was confusing. This is the article.
Oh. Here, that's fine. So if you look at the two brief passages, let's try to do two things. Let's try to understand what the mitzvah is in terms of what it actually requires. What are we obligated to do? And a little bit, perhaps, if you can, what the Torah seems to be telling us about the purpose of this mitzvah. And I'll give you one little hint at what I think we should look at. The Torah addresses this mitzvah in two different places. First in the book of Shemot, and then in the book of Vayikra. And at least in my opinion, you'll tell me if you agree, the mitzvah is the same, but the way in which the Torah frames it, and perhaps the meaning of what it's supposed to be about looks very different in the two different passages and in the context in which they're presented. Take a look and tell me if you agree and what you think. Okay, yeah, what?
The first one starts with the ani, the fool, with the gear. But it starts with the people who don't have. And remember that you were...
It starts with it, and it also mentions them again in the last pasuk, right?
The emphasis is on the poor. And the second one, the emphasis is definitely on the land.
Okay, excellent. Let's return to that point in 1 second. Let's just talk, what are we supposed to do before we talk about why? What is the Torah command? Well, let's read them together here. The first passage begins, as you said, V'ger lo tilchatz, v'tem yedatem et nefesh ha-ger, ki gerim hayitem be'aretz Mitzrayim. There's a prohibition on taking advantage of the stranger, the immigrant, and sort of a moral statement that, you know, of all nations, you should know better. You, Am Yisrael, were once immigrants and yourselves, so you should know better. And then it switches to what might appear to be something completely different. V'sheish shanim tizra'a et artzecha v'yasafta et tvuata. For 6 years you shall plant your field and gather in the crops. In other words, the normal agricultural procedures should be followed for 6 years. V'hashvi'it, and in the 7th year, tishmetena unitashta. How do they translate that here? Thou shalt let it rest and lie fallow. But the word tishmetena, shmitah, perhaps could also be translated a little bit differently. Lishmot means to release. Unitashta, they translate as lie fallow, but litosh, right? Ki lo yitosh Hashem amo. Right? That means lintosh is to abandon. Right? So a more literal translation, perhaps, is that in the 7th year you should release it and abandon it. V'achlu evyonei amecha. You're going to abandon your field, the field that you plant and plow and work in and harvest and take to market the other 6 years. In the 7th year you abandon it. And who comes in instead? The poor people. V'achlu evyonei amecha. V'yitram tochal chayat ha-sadeh. If anything's left, then the animals will eat it. Kein taseh lechar mecha lezeitecha. Here as well, this applies in all of the major agricultural forums, in the field, in the vineyard, and in the olive grove, which are the same products, crops that we've been speaking about. Okay, so the mitzvah seems to be, it doesn't give us too many details here, but the mitzvah seems to be to release the land, to just walk away from the field. Not work the field, but also not do what? Well, not work in it, not do a harvest, and also, though, we're supposed to abandon it, meaning?
Not to pay attention to it at all. You're not going to fertilize it. You see, I'm not going
okay.
to do anything, but I'll just fertilize the land.
Right, okay, so you can't do anything. No preparation for future crops.
But it becomes heifer.
But also, right, correct, also means you can't lock up the gate, right? It says you have to abandon it, and other people can come in. Now, we'll see that halachically, this is not a gift to the poor. Well you know, I'll get to that in a minute. Here it appears as if it's a gift to the poor. Here it appears as if this mitzvah is another category. We had for 6 years, we have leket, shikha, and pe'ah, right? Which means I'm harvesting most of the crops, but I'm leaving behind that which falls and that which I forget and the edge of the field for the poor. In the 3rd year and the 6th year, one of my tithes is also going to the poor. And then every 7 years, they get the whole thing. That's what it sounds like. And then, of course, what am I going to eat?
Well, but you become one of those people who...
But here it doesn't sound that way. Here it says, v'achlu evyonei amecha. Here it says the poor eat it, and the animals eat it. Right? And here it seems to be very much in that category of a mitzvah of matnot evyonim, or matanot aniyim, a mitzvah of, which is a socially based law providing for the poor. That's the way it's presented to us, both by the words and by the context in the book of Shemot. Yes?
But once again, we need to get back to what is the definition of a poor person. Because all of a sudden, if you have no food, guess what?
Then you're going to become poor too, right? Okay. So, right. So that we could get into that, but in the end, we're not going to have to in this case because of the following. In the book of Vayikra, the same mitzvah is presented with a little bit more details, and also with, as you mentioned, with a very different emphasis. Vayidaber Hashem Moshe b'har Sinai le'mor, Deber al b'nei Yisrael v'marta lehem ki tavo el ha'aretz asher ani noten lachem. When you come into the land, I should have mentioned before reading the next word, the idea of 6 years of working in the field and a seventh year of not working in the field, that certainly evokes what image? Shabbat, right? We have 6 days that we work and a seventh day that we don't work. And now we have 6 years that we work and a seventh year that we don't work. In Shemot, I could come up with that parallel on my own. It's not mentioned, though. But in Vayikra, that's exactly what it's called. Ki tavo el ha'aretz asher ani noten lachem v'shavta ha'aretz Shabbat Lashem, the land should rest, observe, as if the land itself observes Shabbat. And who is the Shabbat for, according to this? For God. It doesn't say that this is a mitzvah of taking care of poor people, a mitzvah, what we call Bein Adam L'Chaviro. It doesn't present it here as a social mitzvah. Here it presents it as a religious mitzvah. Right? This is between you and God. Sheish Shanim Tizra Sadecha, V'sheish Shanim Tizmor Karmecha, V'asafta Tvuata. For 6 years you shall plant the land, plant the fields, or prune the vineyards. U'vashana ha'shvi'it, Shabbat Shabbaton, Yehiyeh la'aretz Shabbat Lashem. Again, it's for God. Sadcha lo tizra, v'charmecha lo tizmor. Et tzviach kitzircha lo tiktzor, v'et invei nizirecha lo tivtzor. Shnat Shabbaton, Yehiyeh la'aretz. Here we have the four primary prohibitions that exist in the Shemitah year, or actually they're called melachot. The same word that we use for the prohibited activities on Shabbat. There are 39 milachot, 39 prohibited activities, or I should say prohibited categories of activities. And in the Shemitah year, there are four. Sadcha lo tizra b'charmecha lo tizmar. You cannot plant in a field, nor can you prune a vineyard. When you prune a fruit tree, particularly a grapevine, it's a process that stimulates future growth. And therefore, pruning a vineyard is somewhat parallel to, because fruit trees don't need to be planted in a field where you grow grains or vegetables. You have to plant them every time, right? You plant a wheat seed, the stalk of wheat grows, and that's it. If you want another crop the next year, you have to plant the next year. That's not the case when you have a vineyard or an orchard. Trees produce fruits every year, but you have to take care of them. If you don't prune the trees, if they get overgrown, you're not going to get good crops. Or you're not going to get sufficient crops, and they're not going to be of good quality. So the activity of pruning the vineyard is parallel to planting seeds in the field. That's what you do in order to ensure the next year's crop. And you're not allowed to do either of those things in the Shemitah year. And then it continues, Et tzviach kitzircha lo tiktzor, vet invein zirecha lo tivtzor. You're also not allowed to harvest the fields. Now, if you didn't plant in the fields, well, then assumedly nothing grew. So what does it mean to tell me not to?
Things itself seed.
Correct, exactly. And that's what's called svichim. Very good. That's the term here. In other words, if I have a field that I planted a grain in every year, and I don't sow, I don't do a proper planting, I don't plow the field and plant the seeds, I'm not going to get anywhere near the crop I normally get. But things will grow. There are always going to be seeds that naturally fell off the things. Things will grow a much smaller percentage, but there will be crops. And they may not be of as good quality, but crops will grow. And those crops I'm not allowed to harvest. Et tzviach kitzircha, that which grows on its own, lo tiktzor, you shall not harvest. Ve'et invei nizirecha lo tivtzor, and the grapes that grow in the vineyard, which also, since I didn't prune it, may not be of the same quality or quantity, but there certainly will be grapes on the vine. You cannot harvest those either. Shnat Shabbaton yel aretz. Vaitah Shabbat aretz lachem li'ochla. And instead, the produce of the land shall be for you li'ochla. You are supposed to eat it. Now here, I'm sorry? Ah, very good. So this pasuk causes us to reevaluate two commands we read earlier. First, the one we read in the previous pasuk. It says we can't harvest it. How am I supposed to eat it? It also said that the poor people are allowed to eat it, right? So clearly, the prohibition of harvesting here does not refer to the simple act of severing the connection of the plant from the ground or from the tree, which on Shabbat, for example, that is a prohibited activity, right? To go out on Shabbat and pick a fruit off a tree is a malacha. It's prohibited. And here also we have a prohibition of ktsira, of harvesting, but it obviously can't mean the same thing, or else, as you point out, then the next pasuk makes no sense. So it must be that, and this is how the rabbis understand it, that the prohibitions of harvesting are to do some sort of a wholesale industrial type process where you harvest everything in one path, as opposed to going in and cutting or picking a small quantity for individual use. And this affects both the timing and the quantity of the harvest, and also perhaps may involve the tools that are used and the processes that are used, right? But so there's some sort of prohibition. It also, however, causes me to reevaluate the pasuk that we read earlier. Earlier it said that this is for the poor people. Here it says, "Vaytasha ba'taretz lachem li'achla," right? And we pointed out if I'm a wealthy farmer, I can fantasize, right, about being wealthy. If I'm a wealthy farmer who has lots and lots and lots of money, and I give it to the poor people every year, I give them their gifts. I'm a charitable person, but in the end of the day, they're still poor and I'm still wealthy. I took care of them. But if in the Shemitah year, if I have to walk away from my fields and they can take everything and I can't take anything, then I just became a poor person. And then you ask, so who's poor if I have nothing, right? So here it says, no, you can have it too. And this is how the rabbis understand this pasuk. It's not that you can't go into your field and take anything. You can. But you have no more or less rights than the poor person does. It doesn't actually belong to you in the Shemitah year. Tishmetena unitashta, walk away from it. And now it's available to any person. It's even available to animals. Among those people, I can also go in. But what I can't do is hire my teams of workers and come with my tractors and my equipment and harvest the whole crop. The same way the poor people can go in and pick a little here and a little there, so can I. But no more than anyone else. It's not mine for this year. So now we know two things. We know the fundamental prohibitions and obligations, right? We have at least four prohibited activities, and we have at least one positive requirement of releasing the land and allowing others to come in. And we seem to get some sense of what the idea behind it is, although we have two very different models. In Sefer Shemot, it sounds like this is part of the system of taking care of poor people and social justice and that sort of thing. In the book of Vayikra, it sounds like this is between man and God. It sounds like it's sort of a religious obligation. And what mitzvah is explicitly paralleled here? Shabbat. So which is this? Is this between man and man or between man and God? It's obviously both. Yes?
Do people hoard or collect produce and stuff before the year? Is it allowed to do that?
Before the Shemitah year, it's certainly allowed. In fact, you're supposed to even. But what's prohibited to do, and I didn't give you Mishnayot about this because there's just not enough time, but it's prohibited to do that during the Shemitah year. In other words, you could go around and make a whole business out of this. You could go around and collecting stuff from all the fields and then set up shop and sell it. And actually, we will see a Mishnah that indicates that that's not allowed. Sort of indirectly, but that indicates that. Before the Shemitah year is what you're supposed to do. The Torah says, I didn't give you that pasuk, but the Torah says later on, and if you say, v'chi tomar, mano chava shana shvi'it, what are we supposed to do? The amount of trust in God that's required here is extraordinary. I mean, think about it for a minute. Let's translate this into our terminology. Imagine someone told you, take a year off from work. And not because you have a sabbatical and a savings plan. Just quit your job for a year. Even if your boss tells you it's a leave of absence. Right? But no, not a paid leave. Quit your job for a year. And God will take care of you. So there are people that can afford to do that. I'm certainly not one of them. And now, imagine that he tells the entire country to do that. We're just going to shut down all the businesses. And all the factories and all the everything we do. We're just going to shut everything down. Everybody just take a year off. That's what the Torah told us to do. Again, remember, an agricultural society. We're not talking about today where 2 or 3% of the population, you know, grows agricultural products and then we come up with all kinds of loopholes to allow them to continue. We're talking about an agricultural society where the Torah tells everybody, listen, even observing Shabbat, you know, my grandfather, Alav HaShalom, came from Poland to the United States in the early part of the 20th century, and it was a tremendous, tremendous sacrifice, a sacrifice that many people, including my grandfather, just didn't feel they could, and I'm not here to judge, to take off one day of work. In many cases, people were manual laborers, day laborers. You had to work 7 days a week. And if you wanted to keep Shabbat, you had to quit your job on Friday and hope you could find another job on Sunday,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And sometimes you wouldn't, right?
He,
and
so he got that paid on Saturday.
Oh yeah, even that he never told me. But if you can imagine, now take that sacrifice and make it for an entire year. That's what the Torah is asking us to do. So when the Torah says, addresses that point, and by the way, this is also why. For example, the prophet Yirmiyahu tells us that the people didn't keep this mitzvah. In the 70 years of exile in Babylonia after the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash were meant to be punishment or in some sense, to make up for the 70 sabbatical years that weren't kept. And the people didn't really keep this mitzvah because I don't know if it's too challenging, but it's very challenging. And so the Torah says, what are you going to do? God will bless you. He'll bless you in the sixth year. You'll have enough in the sixth year to last you all the way through till the eighth year. Right? So you're supposed to, it's perfectly legitimate and even required to save produce, right? In the sixth year, whatever I have to leave, like a chikan payah for the poor people. And I have to give. I have to give truma and maaser rishon, and in the sixth year I have to give maaser ani. And what's left, that 81% is mine. I'm supposed to save some of that 81% to get me through the next year. Right? But from the Shemitah year itself, it's open to everybody. Yes?
Why are you really not having it for 2 years? Because you're not
going to
have something in 8 years,
you're going to have seven. So the Pasuk actually says that you'll get enough in the sixth year to last for 3 years. The sixth, the seventh, it's not really 3 full years. But certainly it has to last you for the sixth, for the seventh, and for part of the eighth as well. Right? There's a Pasuk, I believe it's in Dvarim, that Pasuk. It's either in Dvarim or... Or later on here in Vayikra, I have to check. Maybe while I'm talking, I'll check. Okay, and it seems that there's a dual aspect to it. By the way, this is just a side point. The Torah connects mitzvah of Shemitah to the mitzvah of Shabbat. Is Shabbat between man and man or between man and God? It's also both. If you look carefully in the book of Shemot, in the Ten Commandments, there it's presented as Sheshet yamim tavod ve'asita kom lachtecha ve'yom ha'shvi'i Shabbat l'Hashem Elokecha lo tasa kom lacha. And it says Shabbat l'Hashem Elokecha. Why? Ki sheshet yamim asa Hashem et ha'shamayim ve'et ha'aretz. God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. So you should also work for 6 days and rest on the seventh in order to remember that God created the world that way. That's the way it's presented in Shemot, and it seems very much to be a religious principle that we have to remember that we're not the masters of this world. Person goes out and produces things and thinks that he's in control. Once every 7 days he has to stop and remember, and the 7 days reminds him of the 7 days of creation, there's somebody upstairs who's in charge. In Dvarim, it says something completely different in the Ten Commandments, which there it says, Lema'an yanuach avdecha v'amatcha kamocha. Your servant, your slaves, they have to be able to rest just like you can rest. There it's given a social, right? For 6 days, there's a master and there's a slave, there's an employer and an employee, and but on the seventh day, it's different. I'm sorry, this seems to be the last one. Oh, there's more over there, I see. Okay. And there it doesn't talk about the creation of the world. There it says, V'zacharta ki eved hayita ve'eretz Mitzrayim. Remember that you were a slave in Egypt, similar to what the Torah says here. So Shabbat as well seems to combine these two elements. And although I don't have time, I'll just throw out an idea. There's something deeply, deeply profound about that. People often discuss, what's more important, the religious aspects of Torah or the social aspects of Torah. And I know there are people who, particularly in recent decades, in this area of Yerushalayim, there's a number of organizations and a number of individuals that are very, very passionately promoting the idea that we have to focus on the social justice aspect of the Torah And in some cases, you get the impression from such people that they believe that these are more important than the religious aspects. I don't know if I've ever heard anybody claim that the religious aspect is more important than the social aspect, but I've certainly heard people accused of that by others, whether truly accused or falsely accused. When you look at a mitzvah like Shabbat or like Shemitah, perhaps the point is that the entire debate is off, because it's not a question of which is more important than the other, but the two are inextricably intertwined. Somebody who doesn't know how to care for the poor and the weak and can't really worship God. On the other hand, perhaps the Torah is saying that the only way to really understand how to treat another person is if you worship God. And the two are one and the same, right? You have to, let's look at Shemitah, you have to release the land because it doesn't belong to you, it belongs to God. And that causes you, therefore, to realize that the poor person has as much right to it as you do. And if you are wealthy and he's poor, that's not because God, it's not because you're any better than he is, right? And so it could be that instead of trying to figure out or argue about which of these two aspects is the dominant one and which one is the subsidiary one, perhaps we should realize that we need them both. And if you ignore either side, you're going to ultimately be deficient in the other side as well. That's just a throwaway thing. And now we'll get back to Loza Shemitah. Yes?
I don't see here, I've never read it this way, that they're really talking about orchards. You know, if you look, it's a very specific vineyard, so a field.
Well, first of all,
in
the first in the book of Shemot, it mentions karmecha and zeitecha. It mentions grapes and olives also. In the last word in the first source.
But that's only, it's very specific. In other
right.
laws, if it's that specific, that's what it means. Not
well. First of all,
peaches and bears. And
well, okay. So, in general, a full answer to that question would need to examine how Torah Shebaal Peh works,
right,
and how the rabbis take words in the Torah and extrapolate from it. I will tell you, though, we saw both on Sunday and on Monday that the normal three crops that the Torah addresses are dagan, tirosh, v'yitzar, grain, and wine, and oil. Here, it's those exact same three crops are addressed, but here it refers to the place that they're grown. So instead of talking about a field and a vineyard and an olive grove, that's those same three crops. In general, the rabbis understand that to refer to a broader category of things. For some mitzvot, they extrapolate that on the biblical level only to the seven species. In other words, grain, which is the chitan, sorah, and then the grapes and the olives, and then it would also include the figs and the dates and the pomegranates, and you're going to get to the seven. And in other cases, it's extended biblically to refer to basically anything, all fruits.
But now we consider it all fruits.
Well, if not, again, the details, some of it's the arayta and some of it's the rabbanan, but yes. So now let's look at some of the practical applications of this, not the contemporary practical applications, but what's in the Mishnah. Yes?
I think that the key is we have to accept the fact that land is a gift from Hashem, and
right.
we have to look after it, and we cannot abuse it. In other words, if we keep constantly planting and taking and taking and taking,
very good.
Rather than giving the land.
So you're seeing also an ecological...
A Shabbat, because we need the land to keep feeding us, and we don't look after it.
That's very interesting. There are some of the early commentaries also. First of all, people involved in agriculture know that you have to let land, you have to rotate crops or even let land lay fallow periodically. There are those who claim, not only modern scholars, but there are some of the Rishonim, some of the early rabbinic commentaries, who see such a justification in this mitzvah as well. It's a little bit difficult to argue that this is primarily an agricultural, you know, that the goal here is for agricultural purposes, because you talk
but
to any...
Symbolic.
Oh, exactly. Exactly what I'm going to. If my purpose was just to produce better crops, I wouldn't let the entire country lie fallow. I would, maybe even if it's once every 7 years, so then I would divide my land up into seven sections and so that I can eat every year, right? But there are those who see such an element in this mitzvah, and what you've just done is you've placed that back into the moral and spiritual, right? But that's very good. In other words, what you're saying is that there is a practical benefit to this, that by allowing the land to lay fallow, it will be able to rejuvenate itself, and we're going to benefit economically in the other years. But doing it in this context makes that into a moral and spiritual principle as well.
But you also have to have reverence for
right. I mean, exactly.
Given to us
right.
To use and to husband carefully.
Right.
Not to abuse.
Right. That's a very, very interesting way of looking at it. Yeah. Okay. So if we could turn to the... Yes. That's an interesting question.
Because when we read it, it says, Sheshet Yamim Tavo,
Gizra.
It sounds almost like a command. So I wonder, if I am God a piece of land, am I commanded to work the land or decide?
That's an interesting question.
I want to be a shoemaker or whatever.
So let me ask you a different question. Let's say you have another profession. Are you obligated to work 6 days a week? Sheshet Yamim Tavod Vasita Kom Lachtecha. Or are you allowed to live a life of leisure and not work?
But when we talk about the land, it's
right.
Different.
Halachically speaking, at least mainstream halachic opinion does not see either of those verses, the one about Shabbat and the one about Shemitah, as containing a halachic imperative. You're not obligated to work on days that are not Shabbat, and you're not obligated to work the land. Particularly, for example, let's say it's not economically feasible for you to do so, or for whatever other reason. But perhaps there is a moral or spiritual imperative there that we're supposed to be working, right? And the land is supposed to be, we're supposed to be producing something with the land. Now, you don't have to farm it. You could build a house on it. You could turn it into a nature reserve. You could use it for some other purpose. But perhaps there is an imperative there that you're not supposed to, just leave things, you know, undeveloped or undealt with. You know, again, I'm not, you know, maybe there's value to nature reserves that should, and the way you, but then you may have to take care of them by simply making sure that they're left in their natural state. Meaning, I don't know, but I think there's definitely on the philosophical level, I think there's a lot to talk about here. But halachically, I'm not aware of an opinion that looks at it that way. Yes.
Isn't the dependence that those of us who live in Israel have on Hashem reminiscent of man?
There certainly is a connection to the man. I think you're correct. And again, just another throwaway line. I'm fighting the urge to speak about this for 10 minutes. But just another throwaway line. The man is the first place in the Torah where Shabbat comes up with practical ramifications. And the fact, therefore, that there's a connection between the man and Shabbat, a connection which we, in our practice, evoke, among other things, by the practice of having two loaves of bread when we make hamotzi on Shabbat, in order to remember the man, certainly, I think, you know, leads to that connection. We'll leave it at that. Okay. I spoke about that for an hour this past year on Rosh Hashanah Rabbah, about the connection between the man and Shabbat and Parnassa in general, etc. Okay. The laws of Shemitah, as presented by a sampling of Mishnayot in Masechet Shvi'it. First of all, the laws of Shemitah, I alluded to this earlier, begin at the end of the sixth year, parallel to the fact that the laws of Shabbat begin on Friday afternoon. There are things that you have to do to prepare for Shabbat. There are things that are prohibited as we get close to Shabbat. And there's also an obligation to take Shabbat upon ourselves a little bit early. Right? There's a practice of lighting candles in Yerushalayim. At least in theory, it's 40 minutes before sunset. At least that's what it says on the calendars. I don't know what people actually do. I do know what people actually do. In other places, it's 18 or 21 minutes, in theory, on the calendar. There is a obligation to begin Shabbat early and also to prepare for it in advance. And the same thing is true for the Shemitah year. There are things that are prohibited towards the end of the sixth year. So for example, in the first Mishnah here, Ad Eimatai Chorshin Sdei HaIlan Erev Shvi'it. If I have what's called a Sdei Ilan, a field where trees are grown, which in the Mishnah referred to it as a tree field, we normally use other terms like orchard or vineyard or something like that. A field in which you're going to plant fruits as opposed to a field in which you're going to plant perennial crops. So there, until when are you allowed to plow that field before Shemitah? Et shamei omrim kol zman shu yafel apri, uveitil omrim ad ha'atzeret. You're not allowed to plow that field the day before the Shemitah year. Because the only purpose of doing that would be to prepare for something to happen during the Shemitah year when you're not supposed to do that. Now obviously, at the beginning of the sixth year, for example, when you still have a full year of agricultural work ahead, you're allowed to plow the field. The question is, when does it stop becoming when do we stop looking at what you're doing as legitimately serving the needs of the sixth year when you're allowed to work, and when is it already considered prohibited because you're already sort of projecting into the Shemitah year? Beit Shammai says, as long as it's of value to the existing fruits on the trees, he doesn't give an exact date, Beit Hillel says until Shavuot. Until Shavuot of the Shemitah year. I'm sorry, of the sixth year. The sixth year. The Krovim Divrei Elu Liyot Ki Divrei Elu says the Mishnah, there's not that much practical difference between them. That's what I meant when I said less than a year from now, there are certain types of things that are already prohibited. Most of them don't kick in until Tu B'Av, but some already from Shavuot on, this coming Shavuot, which will be the end of the sixth year, already there are certain restrictions that begin to apply. On the other hand, other things you can do, Misaklin, the second Mishnah on the page, which is from the second chapter, Misaklin, in a field where you grow grains, one of the things that you need to do to prepare for a harvest is to remove stones. Over the course of a year, you know, there may be stones that either blew in, got kicked in, or maybe just got kicked up by the plowing, whatever, and you have to clear the land before you plow it. But you also clear land sometimes if there are things in the field, like stones or other things that are inhibiting the growth of the crops, so you may need to deal with that also. So here as well, you have a little bit of a challenge in the sense that this is an activity that will benefit the sixth year's crops and also the seventh year, and therefore it's permitted all the way until Rosh Hashanah. Right? Even on Erev Rosh Hashanah, you can remove the stones from the field, and also certain other things that remove excess branches from the trees and dead branches and things like that. That's Mekarsimim, Mizardim, etc. Ad Rosh Hashanah. Rabbi Yoshua disagrees, and he says, Kizeirudau pisulak shalach hamishit kach shal shishit. You can't go all the way to Rosh Hashanah necessarily. Whatever you did in the fifth year, that's what you can do in the sixth year. And some think that that means that he's being stricter, that in the fifth year it could be that you stopped doing this, let's say, in the middle of the summertime and didn't really need to do it afterwards, and therefore if you are doing it afterwards, it's really showing that you're doing it because you know you can't do it in the seventh. Others think that he may even be more lenient, and that it could be that there are things you can do after Rosh Hashanah if they're to benefit last year's crops. There may be some things from last year that you still haven't harvested. The fruits on the trees, for example. And according to some, Rabbi Yoshua thinks that even after Rosh Hashanah, if agriculturally these activities belong to last year's crops, maybe it'll be permitted. So there's some debate here about exactly when these things kick into effect. But the Shemitah year itself begins on Rosh Hashanah. Yes.
My problem with some of these things is that he lived at the time when supposedly Shemitah was being, so they should have known what the Masorah was over the years, that there shouldn't be this much, I would think there wouldn't be this machloket.
Wait, are you asking me about the machlok between Rabbi Yeshua and the first opinion of the Mishnah, or are you asking me about the difference of opinion about what Rabbi Yeshua meant?
Both.
Okay. So the difference of opinion about what Rabbi Yeshua meant comes from later authorities that are debating this at a later period in time.
But between Hillel and Shammai.
Right. Well, let's put it this way. You can ask the same question. Let's take, for example, the laws of Shabbat or Kashrut. As we all know, there are significant debates among the rabbis. And these are laws we observe today. Shouldn't they know what we do?
Well,
the answer is there's a debate. And some people do this and some people do that.
But with the laws of Kashrut, my father, Rabbi Shalom, was a butcher.
Uh-huh.
So I know in Chicago, I know how certain things changed over the years because of the change of understanding and pollution, which can change,
okay,
affect how things are in an animal, and just the way our economy worked. I mean, at one time the slaughterhouses were in Chicago. Now the slaughterhouses are, who knows, in Iowa or something.
Right.
So there's a change. There's a way we do things has changed. But here, I mean, things
well,
have changed.
Well, I think both aspects you're going to find there also. In other words, whenever you have a debate in the Mishnah, so about something that's a practical relevance, you can always ask, well, what are people doing? And it could be that the opinion, let's say, of Beit Hillel is dominant, and Beit Shammai is an opinion, you know, that has been overruled, let's say, in practical speaking, but they are still presenting their position. It could be that there are two different practices that are going on, and back then there was a debate, and certainly in the Talmud you see that from time to time, that the people of this city did it this way. Some of those debates eventually arrived at a consensus. And also, as you say, though, there are also changes in circumstances that may, and particularly something like this which is dependent on agricultural realities that may change due to all sorts of factors: climate change, economic changes, new technologies. That's also true. That's also definitely the case. You know, what you may do if you have a grape vineyard here in the hills of Yerushalayim at 700 or 800 or 900 meters above sea level, the people who have vineyards down in the valleys may have to, I assume, have to, you know, do things at different times and maybe growing different types of crops and all sorts of that, how much water there is and millions of other factors. Okay. Now, the Shemitah year, there's a common misconception nowadays, and that is that people think incorrectly that it's prohibited to eat the fruits of the Shemitah year. Sometimes you'll pick up a, this is a bottle of water, but if you pick up a, nothing here would say it, but if you look on many packages of different types of products here in Israel, when they're giving you the kashrus information, they'll sometimes say something like, L'lo chashash tevel orla v'shvit. Okay, tevel and orla are categories of forbidden fruits and vegetables. So they tell you there's no, you don't have to worry that the thing in here might be tevel, which would make it prohibited, might be orla, which might be prohibited, or that it's from the Shemitah year. The statement is a meaningful statement, but it's a misleading one because it leads people to think incorrectly that it's prohibited to eat the fruits of the Shemitah year. The Torah said to us, and we read it on the first side of the page, Vayta Shabbat Ha'aretz Lachem Le'ochla. It's there to be eaten. In fact, according to the Ramban, we do not accept this opinion, bottom line in Halacha, but the Ramban thinks that it's even a mitzvah to eat the fruits of the Shemitah year. We assume that it's not a mitzvah exactly, but it's certainly permissible, and perhaps even spiritually beneficial. As we'll see in a moment, the fruits of the Shemitah year have special sanctity. So, min HaTorah, it is permitted to eat everything that grows in the Shemitah year. The rabbis did institute a prohibition, and I deal with this a little bit in the article here. There's a fundamental difference between the fruits of trees and between perennial crops like, that's the correct term, right? Things that have to be planted every year, perennial crops like grains and vegetables. The vineyard and the orchard, you're not allowed to prune it and to do other things to take care of it, but in principle, there's going to be a crop. In the fields, in principle, there isn't going to be a crop because you didn't plant, and the only thing that will grow are whatever small quantities grow from there. The Torah addressed those two things we saw the same way. Already in the time of the Talmud, we spoke about the terrible challenge, maybe terrible is the wrong word, but the strong, overwhelming challenge that it is to observe these laws. And there were people even back then who didn't stand up to this challenge. And there were people who were secretly planting seeds in their fields during the Shemitah year. They just couldn't handle the pressure. And they would go out at night or when no one was looking, and they would plant seeds. And, oh, look, you know, I happen to get a lot of things growing in my fields. The rabbis, when they realized that this was going on, decided that the only way to stop this is to issue a rabbinic prohibition, what's called the Isur Svichin. And basically, crops that grow in the Shemitah year that are from plants that need to be planted every year, right? So basically, in our terms, that means grains, although we don't really grow too many grains here in Israel nowadays anyway, but it means grains, and it means also vegetables. Those things, if they grow in Shemitah, are rabbinically prohibited, in principle. Practical ramifications are more complicated, but in principle. Whereas fruits of trees are not prohibited at all. Even the things that are prohibited are prohibited. You know, so for example, if I see a can of pickles or something made from cucumbers and it says that there's no chashash of shvi'it, then it means that there's if those cucumbers did grow in the Shemitah year, it's possible that it's prohibited to eat them. Okay, but if I have a package of a bottle of orange juice, for example, the orange juice, even if it's from the Shemitah year, it's not prohibited. There are restrictions on how it needs to be used, and that's what they're telling me. It's not prohibited. And here, the Mishnah, in the third source on the page here, discusses the fact that you can eat fruits from the Shemitah year, but asks a question that at first glance seems, based on what we've already learned, unclear what they're asking. Me'ematai ochlin perot ha'ilan b'shvi'it. From when am I allowed to eat the fruits of trees in the Shemitah year? Why would there be a prohibition? We talked about how if it asks me something having to do with the vegetables in the garden, perhaps I could understand that as referring to the rabbinic prohibition that we just mentioned. But fruits on trees are permitted, so what is it asking here? What's going on here is that one of the restrictions on the use of fruits of trees that grew in the Shemitah year is that you can only eat them in the normal way. Things that are, you can prepare them in the normal way, and you can eat them in the normal way. So, for example, things that are normally eaten raw, you're not allowed to cook them if they have Kedushat Shavit. Things that are normally eaten only cooked, you're not allowed to eat them raw. You're not allowed to eat a raw potato during the Shemitah year. Things that are eaten like an apple, either cooked or raw, so you can eat them either cooked or raw, but you're only allowed to do what's normally done with them. And therefore, also, you're not allowed to eat fruits that aren't sufficiently ripe. That's not the normal way of eating them. And therefore, the Mishnah says, okay, if you have, I have a lemon tree, which I planted before the last, I hired a guy to plant it, before the last Shemitah year, because I bought a house, we neglected the garden for, a whole bunch of years, and right before Shemitah, we paid someone to come and fix up the garden so that we could neglect it again and fulfill a mitzvah by doing so. And in that context, we planted a tree. And unfortunately, 6 years later, it's somewhat neglected again. Not as bad as it was, but I'm not a farmer. In any case, on any other year, right? If I would do it when the lemons come out, they're small and green and not really very edible. But if I would decide I want to pick a lemon that's not ripe and eat it, that may not be advisable. It may not taste very good. I don't even know if it's healthy, but there's no particular prohibition involved. In the Shemitah year, there is. Because you're allowed to use it, but it's, again, part of the concept here is it's not yours. It's God's. God's letting you in. He's letting you. So he's letting you in, and he's giving you certain guidelines. Okay, that's a broader discussion. Okay, so again, I'd have to answer, if I had the time, I'd have to answer that question on two levels. I'd have to answer the question globally first. What is Torah Shebaal Peh? What are the principles that the rabbis use to derive laws from small hints in the Torah text, and what's the legitimacy behind that principle? And then to show you the exact source of some of these laws, which I didn't put on this page here either. But when I speak of the Torah, in this context, I'm speaking about what we call Torah Shebuktav and Torah Shebaal Peh together. The question is certainly legitimate. I don't mean to minimize it. I just don't have the time to address it here. In any case, I also, by saying that, these laws are, I think, are meant to dramatize to us the fact that God controls land. There's a further explanation necessary to try to figure out, why God cares if I eat the fruit before it's ripe or if I eat it raw or cooked. I don't necessarily have an answer to all the details, but the general principle seems to be that once the Torah is telling me what I can and can't do with it, it certainly, even if I don't understand why, it certainly makes very clear that this is not, no one's telling me what I can do with the fruits of my trees the other years, because they're mine. Right? If someone tells me, look, you can eat it, but only if you follow these rules, that certainly makes it very clear to me that it's not exactly mine.
Does those rules pertain just to the owner or to everybody?
Everybody. Because the owner's not the owner in the Shemitah year. There's no difference. There's no difference between the owner and anybody else. That's exactly the point. So you're allowed to take it the same way everyone else is allowed to take it. No less, but also no more. Okay, I don't have time to go into a full response to that, but I will tell you that there are sources, let's put it this way, there are three periods in history when the laws of Shemitah were dealt with halachically in a very serious way, practically speaking, not just theoretically. One is in the Talmudic period, and I assume the period before that also, that we don't have written records from. The second is in the 16th century when there was a aliyah in the area of Tzfat particularly, and there was the time when the Shulchan Aruch was written. And there was some bit of an agricultural renaissance there as well, and there were Jews that were actually farming land and asking questions about it. And the third period is in the 20th century and onwards. So the modern Hetzer Mechira was done first, I think, at the very end of the 19th century. I think 1890-something was the first time, Rav Kook's Hetzer Mechira, but it was based on something that had been suggested and implemented in some form a few hundred years earlier in Tzfat. Okay, yeah. Oh, we'll get to that in a minute. Also to other things. Okay. She wants to know whether, we talked yesterday, for example, about agricultural products that aren't eaten, like cotton and things like that. She wanted to know whether the laws of Shemitah apply to those also. Yesterday we said Trumot Masor is only for foods. We'll get to that in a okay, so we'll get to at least some of that in a minute. But just to continue the Mishnah we were looking at, Me'ematai Ochlin Perot Ha'ilan. So it gives us rules. Hapagim, which are developing figs. So it's very interesting. Mishi Azrichu, when they start to become a little bit dark or reddish, Ochel Behen Pito Basadeh. You can't take them into the house and eat them because it's not normal to do that. But if you're out in the field, there's apparently a stage where people will pick something that's not fully ripe off the tree and eat it that way, but they wouldn't actually bring it into their house and, make a salad out of it or something like that. And therefore, when it reaches that stage, you can eat it in the field. Bichlu, which means when it becomes fully ripe, then kones l'toch beito. What is normally done is what you can do. There's a stage when it's okay to eat it, sort of randomly pick up fruit off the tree and just pop it into your mouth. And there's only a later stage when it's considered legitimate to take it into your house. And that, v'sha'ar shnei ha-shavua, the other years of the week, isn't that an interesting expression? The idea of the Shemitah Shabbat, so there's a week of years. There's 6 years of the week, and then there's the seventh year of Shabbat. The other years of the week, chayavim b'ma'asrot. I believe I skipped those Mishnayot yesterday for lack of time, but when it comes to Truma and Maaser, if you pick it, when I told you that I can pick an unripe lemon off my tree this year if I want and eat it, not only that, I don't have to take Truma and Maaser from it. Right? Normally when I pick the lemon off the tree and take it into my house, I have to take Truma and Maaser. But if I pick it when it's premature and not really considered edible yet, you don't have to take Truma and Maaser. The same stage at which it becomes obligated in Truma and Maaser the other years, that's the stage at which you're allowed to take it into your house during the Shemitah year, because that's the stage at which it's considered appropriate to eat it. And the next Mishnayot give you the exact definitions for grapes and for olives as well. The next set of Mishnayot discuss the question that you just asked about what about things that are not foods. Klal gadol amru b'shvi'it. Kol shehu ma'achal adam me'ochel adam u'me'ochel behema. Okay, things that are edible for animals or for people. Umi minat sov'in, or things that you grow to be used as colorings, as dyes. So here we have an example of something that's not a food product at all. Right, you're growing indigo, for I don't know if that grows in Israel, but something like that, plants that are used to make dyes out of, to produce coloring agents. Ve'eno mitkayim ba'aretz, and if it's the type of thing that has to be harvested at a certain point of time, you can't leave it in the ground for longer or it will rot. Those things, yesh lo shvi'it uledamav shvi'it, yesh lo bi'ur uledamav bi'ur, very briefly, let me just explain what that means. Yesh lo shvi'it means it has the holiness of shvi'it, of Shemitah. Okay, which means, for example, that it's covered by some of the rules we talked about. One of the rules of Kedushat Shvi'it that we just talked about is that you're not allowed to eat foods in an unusual way. There are other rules. You're not allowed to destroy Perot Shvi'it. I'll just throw out one practical ramification of this that comes up. You're not allowed to do things that destroy the food. Now, in general, we're not supposed to be destroying food for no reason, but there are things that we normally do that aren't allowed in the Shemitah year. For example, when you get wine from the Shemitah year, which was only in the eighth year, wine that was produced from grapes that ripened on the vines during the Shemitah year, but because wine lasts for a long time, you can get, I just recently had a bottle of wine that said on it that it was from the Shemitah year. You have to read the bottles of wine carefully. There are things you're not allowed to do with that wine. For example, many people have a custom when we make Havdalah that we spill out a little bit of the wine afterwards and use the wine to extinguish the Havdalah candle. And there's mystical reasons for that. Not with Shemitah wine. That's not allowed. Right? You make Havdalah. It doesn't mean you can't use it for Havdalah. You just can't fulfill that little custom. If that custom's important to you, then find another bottle of wine. But don't do it that way. You're also not supposed to fill the cup up. Normally there's an idea in Kiddush that we should daf, or Kiddush, and any kosher bracha, the cup should overflow, and it's a sign of not with Shemitah wine. Right? So things that there's... You can't fill the cup... normally we fill the cup so that it should overflow a little bit. Because it says, because this is holy wine, because it comes from holy fruits, and therefore it has to be treated with special respect. You can't waste it, even in ways that it wouldn't be considered wasteful for other, in other purposes, right? You're not allowed to take shemitah in principle. In principle, you're not allowed to take shemitah fruits out of the country, right? You're not allowed to, we shouldn't be exporting. Every so often, there's a, again, they're practically speaking, there are discussions about it, but in theory at least, we should not supposed to be exporting these products, etc.
Yes.
Etrogim wines. Again, if you rely on the Heter Mechira, then the Heter Mechira remove, according to those who accept it, removes the sanctity, and then it allows us to export. Okay. So, there's also a mitzvah called Bi'ur. Bi'ur means that at the end of the Shemitah year, not at the end of the year, there are crops in the fields. And I go out, let's say I have a field, I have a vineyard, whatever I have. So we said, what I'm not allowed to do is industrially harvest everything and take it, you know, and put it in storehouses and whatever. I am allowed to go out and pick individual quantities the same as anyone else's. It's out there in the field. I take a little bit in my house. I go out tomorrow, take another, or maybe every 2 or 3 days that I take things out. When it reaches the point that naturally it's no longer available in the fields, everything that was on the trees or in the fields has either been eaten or at this point it's going to be rotten, but perhaps I have some in the house that I was able to preserve. Maybe I squeezed it in, you know, I pressed the olives into oil or something like that, and then there's no more olives on the tree, but the oil, or I dried the fruits or whatever. You're not allowed to have it in your house anymore either. It's called bi'ur. You have to remove it from your house. Some say that you can remove it from your house and then bring it back in. Others say it has to be gone completely. Those of you who live in Israel might remember something about Erev Pesach, people taking out bottles of wine and grape juice the year after the Shemitah year and putting them out on the street corner and declaring them, you know, hefker, and then going back out a little later and taking them back in. That's what this is based on. So these laws of Biur and Shvit apply to the products that are mentioned in Mishnah Aleph there. Mishnah Bet mentions other products where some of these laws apply and not others. But since I only have a minute, let me just. Absolutely. Absolutely. We talked about a few of them here, and there are others as well. Definitely. Definitely. There was all sorts of fraud going on and all sorts of even abuse at times that the rabbis had to deal with. And, you know, this law is a law that the Jewish people never really observed properly because it is one of the most difficult laws to observe. And it remains sort of a only partially realized vision. But on the other hand, read one more Mishnah, and then I'll wrap this all up because I'm basically out of time. If you look at the second to last Mishnah, Shvi'it nitenet la'achila, you ask, what are we allowed to do other things with them, right? So you can eat it, l'shtia, you can drink it, l'sicha. Sicha is, we talked about yesterday also, they used to use olive oil for skin treatment. People tell me it's still good, actually, right? So you're allowed to, that's a normal use for it, and you're allowed to use it for that also. Second to last one. And then the last one, though, says, Ein mochrin perot shvi'it. Lo b'minav, lo b'mishkav, lo b'minyan. You're not supposed to do business with it. You're not allowed to sell them, but it's not exactly that you're not allowed to sell it. You're not allowed to sell it in industrial quantity. You can't, like, weigh them, or you can't sell them by the kilo, and you can't sell them by the dozen, you know, or something like that. You can sell an individual, you know, sort of, again, the idea is we're not supposed to be doing business with it. If I have a couple of apples, I can sell them to somebody. But if I do that, then the money that's paid for it also gets the sanctity of Shvi'it and has to be dealt with accordingly. Today we have ways around this also called Otsar Beitin. Again, the details are there if you're interested.
What's happening is exchange.
I'm sorry?
What's happening is
exchange as well. If we do a barter, right? I have grapes that have Shvi'it and you have, that have Kedushat Shvi'it, and you have figs from last year, and you give me, we exchange them, then what you give me in exchange also gets the holiness of Shvi'it. But let me end with this one point. On the one hand, these laws are very, very difficult. They always have been, and they remain difficult. On the other hand, there's something very, very unique about this. We talked yesterday about the fact that Truma and Maaser Sheni, and there are other examples of that as well, foods that have sanctity are generally prohibited to us nowadays because in the state of Tum'ah, we're not allowed to consume them. That rule does not apply to Shavit. And basically, this is the only example that we have in Halakha where we have, there are many examples in Halakha of sanctified foods, but almost all of them either don't exist nowadays, like the meat of a sacrifice, or if they do exist, like Truma, or like Ma'aser Sheni, we're not allowed to partake of them. Shemitah is the one exception to that rule. And that's also why people get very, very nervous about it, because it's something that we're, certainly people from outside the land of Israel have, you know, have never experienced this. And even here in Israel, because the trend has often been to sort of avoid these things for various reasons, it's unfamiliar to us. On the other hand, it's a tremendous opportunity to come in contact with an aspect of Torah life that, you know, we don't have in our present reality. Besrat Hashem, very soon that will change. But in the meantime, you know, this is something that's very, very unique. And just to put into the concept, we've looked here over the last 3 days really at, you know, a series of laws that that really address a full range, again, in the agricultural context, but we've also talked about the fact that they have at least symbolic ramifications in other areas of life as well. Really the full range of how to live your everyday life, and also through that reflect all the major principles of what the Torah is trying to teach us, both in terms of holiness and godliness and in terms of care and concern for other people and in terms of running a society that's structured around those things, b'poanim and levi'im and welfare assistance for the poor, v'chule. Okay, thank you very much.